And welcome to the Rick House. My name is Cyrus Farmer, and you are watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast. Welcome to Masters Week. Folks, we have a lot to get into tonight, and I think we're going to try to cover as much ground as we possibly can. I'll give you a little rundown of what we're going to be talking about tonight. Speaking of Masters Week, I'm going to be telling you, some of you know this story, some of you don't, but I will be recounting my first ever attendance at a golf major in person. I'll tell you all about that story. It was quite interesting. I had a really good time, but I'll tell you all about it. We're also going to be giving you our Masters preview. We'll be telling you our picks for who we think is going to win, how we think the tournament's going to go. And of course, everyone's favorite segment, what are you drinking tonight? We'll be covering that as well. But first, I do want to get a couple things out of the way. Let's start with a heartfelt congratulations to Mr. Ovechkin, the women's UConn basketball program, and the men's Florida basketball program for winning their respective tournaments, and for Ovechkin passing Wayne Gretzky, the great one, is the top goal scorer in the history of the National Hockey League. Folks, I'm not much of a hockey guy, but I will say this. I thought when Gretzky set that record, it was literally going to be unbreakable. So for Ovechkin to break that record, and apparently, I don't know if this is true or not, but I think on one of the sports shows, they said that Ovechkin broke the record, tied the record, in one fewer game than it took Gretzky to set the record. So I guess Ovechkin has been this good all the time. I have no idea. But I do know he won a championship for the Nationals. I'm sorry, for the Washington Capitals. And congratulations on a well-earned record. I think it will be incredibly difficult for anyone to break that record. So congratulations to the Washington Capitals and to Ovechkin as well. And folks, I know what you're all thinking, so let's just get it out of the way. We are on day 32 of the Wolf Watch. Yes, the Wolf Gourmet countertop convection oven is still in the dining on the dining room floor in the box, unwrapped. Folks, you might be asking yourselves, why is Cyrus spending so much time talking about this toaster oven? I'm going to give you a couple facts about this toaster oven, and then maybe it'll help you understand why I'm so obsessed with getting it out of the box, outside of the fact that I paid a pretty penny to present it as a birthday gift for my wife. Look, again, it's just a toaster oven. But in so many ways, it's not just a toaster oven. This thing has 7 cooking modes. Let me read them to you. It has a baking mode, a roasting mode, a broiling mode, a warming mode, a proofing mode, a bagel mode, and a toasting mode. Folks, this thing is just a piece of machinery that is so well engineered, who wouldn't want one in their home? Okay. This toaster oven, it has a convection function. What does that mean? Well, a convection is when you actually place a fan inside the oven. So it helps circulate the air inside the oven. Convection cooking actually provides for more even baking and for faster cooking times. I mean, the cooking times can be up to 25% faster with a convection oven. Most people either put the temperature down 25% or they will cut the cooking time down by 25% because that is how effective circulated warm air convection does with cooking in one of these ovens. I got to tell you, the temperature in this Wolf Gourmet countertop oven, it's finely tuned, and it's uniquely calibrated. Folks, most of you have an oven. I don't care whether it's a Samsung, like we have a Samsung oven in our home. I don't care whether it's a Thermador. I don't care whether it's a LG. Whoever makes your oven, most ovens are not calibrated that finely so that if the temperature on the outside of the oven says 300 degrees, the inside of the oven is probably not going to be exactly at 300 degrees. This is one of the advantages of Wolf. They make their products so highly calibrated that if you put the oven for 325, if you take the temperature on the oven, it's going to read 325. It just makes cooking so much, not only so much more efficient, but you get better results when you're cooking at the temperature you think you're cooking at. If you put the oven to 300 and the actual inside of the oven is only 285 degrees, you're going to be off with whatever you're cooking and however you're deciding to make it. Now look, when we were in Los Angeles, we had a Viking range and oven. And I loved the Viking. Viking was great. Except for the igniters. The igniters on the range, on the cooktop, they often went out. We had to change them 3 or 4 times over the course of like 7 years. It's just kind of a bugaboo with Viking. They have igniter issues. But otherwise, the oven itself cooked great. The range was great. But everyone always talks about the Wolf, not only the red knobs on the Wolf, but the actual performance that you get from Wolf products. And again, I cannot wait to try out this gourmet countertop convection oven from Wolf. It's like literally having a small version of a Wolf oven on your countertop. I can't wait to try it, but apparently I'm going to have to continue to wait to try it until my wife decides to open the box her birthday gift came in. So there is that. Now, let's talk a little bit about the first major I ever attended, first golf major I ever attended in person. This all started back in 2002. Now, I was living in New York at the time, and Tiger, he was in his heyday, and he brought his talents to Bethpage Black out in Long Island. It was an interesting tournament. It was one of the tournaments, one of the few tournaments Tiger ever led as a major, wire to wire. He led at the end of every round and went on to win, I think, the U.S. Open by 2 shots over Phil Mickelson that week. But I think this would have been, I think this was by 2002, this was Tiger's 8th major win. And, you know, I kept asking myself this question, literally every single day I watched the tournament. Because Long Island, I was in Manhattan. Long Island was only about a 45-minute drive from where I was. I could, if I'd taken the Long Island Railroad, it probably would have been like a 30-minute trip, door to door. I kept asking myself, look, Tiger's in town. Why on earth are you not at this tournament watching him in person? So that's where it all started. I looked at the U.S. Open website, and I went on their website to see if they were holding any other tournaments in the New York area in the future, U.S. Opens, that was. Turns out, in 2002, they had posted already. You know, they book these sites 2, 3, 4, 5 years in advance sometimes, that the U.S. Open decided to hold the 2006 U.S. Open at Winged Foot Golf Club in Mamaroneck. That's in Westchester County, north of New York City. So at that point, after learning that information, I became a member of the USGA. Obviously, most of you know that's not as big a deal as it sounds. To become a member of the USGA, all you have to do is pay, like, at the time, I think it was like $25. And they give you a bag tag and a rules of golf pocket version handbook that you can stick in your golf bag. and off you go. You're a member. But one of the things, if I'm remembering correctly, that came with the membership is they gave you the right to purchase tickets to any upcoming USGA events. So in 2006, I purchased a package of tickets. I think it was, I don't even remember what it was called, or something like the Champions Club or something like that. But essentially, I purchased tickets in this package for two. And it included all three practice round days, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, as well as two tickets for all four rounds of the tournament, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. They give you like some corporate temp, like access where you can buy food and drink. There's air conditioning. You sit down. You can hang out. You can watch stuff on TV. You can go in and out. There are all kinds of privileges to paying for this package of tickets that I bought. I think at the time it was like $1,500 or something it cost me. So I buy these tickets. As soon as the tickets arrive, probably like a month or two before the U.S. Open, I get on the horn. I call my buddies, one or two buddies. I say, hey, guys, come on out to New York. We're going to the U.S. Open. My treat. I got tickets, right? Call my brother who already lived in New York and my father as well. I said, come up on Sunday. We'll go to the U.S. Open on Father's Day. It'll be great. So that was set. This is 2006 now. Now, I think most of you know by now that I am an actor by trade. I mean, I've spent the last 35 years working as an actor in productions, big and small, on television, film, theater, streaming platforms, you name it, right? So during this time, as an actor, your schedule is always at the mercy of your agent because your agent can call you at any time and say, hey, you have an audition, you have a producer session, you have a callback, you have a screen test. They want to see you for this on day X, whether that's Tuesday or Friday or Thursday or Monday. And whenever they tell you, they, quote unquote, whether it's a director or a producer or a studio, want to see you, you have to take time to prepare. Well, at this point in my life, I was in pretty good shape. I just recorded a pilot for ABC. It was a show called 6 Degrees. And we just taped it. We shot it probably about 6 to 8 weeks prior to the U.S. Open. And we found out that it was well received. It got picked up. And I was about 6 to 8 weeks away from going into production on the series. So the week was slow work-wise, which was great because for me, it just gave me more time to hang out and do the U.S. Open that I bought these tickets for. So I was very, very excited about it. Now, I have to tell you, the week of the U.S. Open, it was great. It started out great anyway. The first day, practice round, Monday, I took the boyfriend of one of my wife's work friends out to Wingfoot, took the train out, and we're walking around the first couple hours looking at all these pros. You're allowed to take pictures on practice day, so I bring my Nikon single lens camera and taking all sorts of pictures, and it's great. Now, of course, we, like everyone else, is looking to see Tiger Woods, whose father, Earl, had just died like just over a month before the start of the U.S. Open. He died shortly after the 2006 Masters and about a month before the U.S. Open. So no one knew whether or not Tiger was going to play. he accepted the invitation. He was going to appear, but we didn't know how he was going to play. So after a couple hours of looking around the course, kind of getting the lay of the land and shooting pictures of some of the other golfers, Patrick Harrington, Colin Montgomery, I decided, let's go back to the clubhouse. All right, let's take a little break and see if we can hang out and, you know, wait for some other golfers to come out on the course. Now, just as we get to the clubhouse, right before, we're probably about 45 feet from walking inside, out of the clubhouse comes, guess who? Tiger Woods. He literally walks right past me, 10 feet to my left. And so instinctively, I put my camera up and I start taking pictures. And we follow Tiger for the next hour, looking at various holes that he's practicing on. He was practicing in that day, I think, with Charles Howell III, and he may have had another golfer with him, not sure. But I do remember Charles Howell III was there with him in that practice round. Got some great pictures of Tiger. Maybe I'll post them this year before the U.S. Open. They're just some tremendous picture of Tiger and other golfers. Fred Couples, it was a lot of fun. So, job one, seeing Tiger in person, check. Now, I have to tell you, it was so cool watching Tiger hit shots, full shots, hit chips, hit putts. You know, Steve Williams was there, obviously. And his practice routine was so involved. It was really, really interesting. Now, I don't remember day two and three, which is Tuesday and Wednesday, of the practice rounds very well. But I do remember, I think there was some weather involved on one or two of those days. So I went to both practice days by myself. I ended up giving my spare ticket to a bystander outside of the Mamaroneck on Tuesday and Wednesday. I wanted to go, and you know, there was no reason to burn the ticket. I just gave it to somebody else who didn't have one who might want to go see what's happening inside. Now, Thursday, first day of the tournament, I took a guy who lived in my apartment building at the time. You know, my doormen were so jealous. They're like, "Hey, I don't have to work. You can take me." But you know, I was like, "Please, I got some packages coming. Just make sure everything's cool here. We'll tell you all about it." Anyway, long story short, Thursday was great. Watching these guys in tournament play, tough conditions. It was really, really impressive. And it was a typical U.S. Open. Wingfoot, obviously, I'm not sure, most of you know this probably, but Wingfoot historically has played as one of the toughest venues for U.S. Open. I think the winning score in 2006 was 5 over. So it's a tough track. And when it's set up for U.S. Open standards, it gets even tougher. So it was just great watching all these pros on Thursday. Day two. Friday was a very bittersweet day for me personally, Cyrus Farmer. My buddies had gotten into town. One came in from the West Coast. One came in from D.C. And about 30 minutes before I was supposed to meet them, and we were all going to the train station to go watch the Friday around, I got a call from my agent. Now, my agent proceeds to tell me that we got a call from ABC telling us that they were going to recast the role that I had shot 6 to 8 weeks earlier, and they were dropping me from the show. Now, I was not a series regular on the pilot, but I was a very heavily recurring character, had planned to be in the show. So obviously, this is a crushing piece of news. It's very annoying. But I got to tell you, learning that they were dropping me from the show wasn't nearly as annoying as learning why they were dropping me from the show. Turns out, according to the studio, they wanted an actor to play my role in a more menacing fashion. Folks, I don't know if you know anything about my resume, but by 2006, I was one of the kings of menace when it comes to playing bad guys. I played a ton of bad guys in my career, and I was one of the kings of menace. I got to tell you, it was really, really annoying because when we were actually shooting the pilot, the writer and the director of the show kept telling me, "Sai, make the character softer. Make him softer. Don't make him so menacing. We want to roll that out later on in the series. For this pilot, make him softer. Make him softer." And folks, I got to tell you, everything in my bones. I don't know everything, but I do know a little bit about characters. And everything in my being was telling me, no, this guy has got to be a tough guy from the very first time you see him on screen. But take after take after take after take, they're telling me softer, softer, softer. So what am I going to do, right? Am I going to play the character the way I think the character should be played and get replaced while we're shooting the pilot because I can't take direction? Or am I going to trust the writer and the director of this project and actually play the character softer? Obviously, I chose to do the latter. But unfortunately, it turns out the studio saw the character very much the same way I saw the character, that he should hit the ground running with menace and, a fear factor. Now, to the show creators' credit, they did fight for me. They told ABC, look, Cyrus was doing a much harder version of this character throughout the entire pilot shoot. I mean, he can kill this character if you let us reshoot the scenes with him. But the studio had someone different in mind, which, you know, that's their right. I even considered giving the tickets to my buddies that Friday morning, heading straight to either LaGuardia or JFK, catching the first flight out to Los Angeles, so that I could plead my case in person to the execs at ABC. But my agent reiterated, they've had somebody else in mind for a little while now. It wouldn't do you any good. Turns out they recast Michael K. Williams in my role. Michael and I worked together on The Wire. Michael was Omar, if any of you guys are familiar with the HBO show, The Wire. Michael played Omar. And he ended up playing the role that I was originally cast in Six Degrees. And so that's that. Again, beyond disappointing. I gotta tell you, it was really, really, really disappointing. But disappointment is part of the entertainment business. It comes with it. It's part and parcel of what we do. So what happened? I moped for about 30 minutes. Picked myself up, dusted myself off, and met my buddies at the train station and go out to see the second round of the U.S. Open. So I'm out there with my buddies on Friday and Saturday. We have a great time. Again, the course is playing incredibly tough. Then comes Sunday. Now, Sunday, my father came in town. My father lives in Georgia. And he came in town for that Father's Day so I could take him and my brother, who lives in New York, to the final round of the U.S. Open. Just the three of us. And folks, I got to tell you, it was one of the most satisfying days of my life. And I have had a lot of satisfying days. Trust me. But going to the final round of the 2006 U.S. Open at Wingfoot, with my father and my brother on Father's Day was absolutely awesome. We walked the course, we watched golfers, We ate, we drank, we smoked cigars, we bonded. It was absolutely awesome. Spent the whole day out there. I had managed to get another pass so that the three of us could go together. So we're all in the tent, kind of cooling down. Tent's air conditioned, obviously. Cooling down, plenty of TVs around, plenty of food to eat, drinks to drink. So we're cooling out at the end of a long day, and Phil reaches the 17th tee. Now, at this point, Phil, I think, is leading by one. Phil Mickelson, he's leading by one. And my father says, hey, why don't we go out to the 18th tee and watch the finish of this tournament? And I look at my dad, I look at my brother. I'm like, hey, guys, look, it's been a long week. It's hot out there. We had watched Phil for several holes to begin with already, and we saw him hit some great shots. But as you can imagine, the crowds were enormous. So I was like, why go outside and fight the crowds? We know he's going to win anyway. Let's just watch it here on TV. We can hear what he has to say. It'll be great. Well, needless to say, we stayed in the tent, and that's when what happened happened. The tent that we were in happened to be right beside the 18th fairway. Folks, I think you know what happened from there. Phil tees off, hits a tent along the 18th fairway, and we could have been outside to witness that in person. But I was too lazy to finish this tournament the way it should have been finished properly, actually watching live outside what happened instead of on TV in the corporate tent. So when I tell you you should always listen to your parents, this story is Exhibit A. Now, your parents are not always right, but sometimes they're not wrong, and it's always worth going the extra mile if all that you're being asked to do is give more effort. So that's my story of the first major I ever watched in person. Subsequently, Jeff Ogilvie won that U.S. Open, as we all know. It was an unbelievable meltdown, but when you watch that highlights of that U.S. Open, one of the things that really becomes apparent is I really miss Johnny Miller. Boy, was he fantastic on commentary. I know some golfers thought he was too tough on them, so on and so forth, but he's so insightful. He's critical, yes, absolutely. But this is from a guy who's won majors, who's lost majors, who had played in a number of big tournaments and at one point was one of the best players in the world, obviously. And to hear him give his insight on golfers, I really miss having him on the call. Johnny Miller was great. I was a big, big, big fan of his announcing career. So let us move on to the Masters preview. Folks, it is a 95-man field. I think it's going to be a wide open tournament. I think there will be so many golfers who can win this week. I really, really think it's going to be very, very exciting. I don't want to say it's going to be a shootout in terms of score, but I think it will be a shootout in terms of the number of golfers who will be in contention on the back nine on Sunday. There are so many golfers who could win this thing. Now, let's get two things out of the way first and foremost. I do not think Scottie Scheffler will win the Masters this week. I think he missed too much time in the beginning of the season. I'm not saying he won't win a major this year. I just don't think he'll win a Masters this week. I think he really could have used a little bit more time to kind of find his form. He played well in Houston a couple weeks ago, but I think there are too many other golfers who are going to have a better chance to win than Scottie. I think Scottie will be in contention. I just don't think he's going to win this week. As I told you 3 weeks ago, I love, love, love Rory McIlroy to win this tournament. I think it's his time. I think he's ready. I think that he is going to overcome all the mental scars that have happened, not only in the Masters, but in other majors as well. And I think he's going to complete the Grand Slam this week. I really, really, really do think Rory is going to win. Now, there are a number of other golfers that I think will be in contention, which I think if Rory wins this, whoever wins this is going to be a great achievement. But if Rory wins this, to complete the career Grand Slam, I think it's going to be a fantastic achievement, because I'm going to tell you some of the golfers that I think that are going to be in contention. Ludwig Oberg, Xander Schauffele, Victor Hovland, Bryson DeChambeau, Hideki Matsuyama, and Joaquin Niemann. Yes, I think Joaquin Niemann is going to play well. I think Joaquin Niemann is going to have a chance to actually win this tournament. I think it will be interesting to see how many live golfers actually contend and finish in the top 10. Now, LIV has only been around 4 years, I think. Their high watermark of contending was in 2023. That's when they had 3 of their golfers in the top 4. And that does not include Jon Rahm, who joined LIV and won that tournament. And he joined LIV a few months after winning the Masters. So it should be a lot of fun. I can't wait to see. And this year, I believe, also marks the 50th anniversary of Lee Elder breaking the color line at Augusta National. So kudos to Augusta National. Real kudos to Lee Elder for accomplishing that feat as well. Folks, I think it's going to be a great tournament. You are going to love this year's Masters. But I know you already know that. All right. Now, we're at the point of the program where I get to ask you my favorite question. What are you drinking tonight? Well, I can tell you what I'm drinking. And that is the Knob Creek Bourbon and Rye. Folks, I'm going to give you some information about this. Then I'm going to tell you what I think about it. This, obviously, Knob Creek, is a product of the Jim Beam Distilling Company based in Claremont, Kentucky. Obviously, it's a small batch. 56.5 ABV. That means it comes in at 113 proof. And I bought this bottle for $51. Folks, the bourbon and rye from Knob Creek, it is a blend, obviously. It is 30% 9-year-old bourbon and 70% 7-year-old rye. Why the bourbon is 9-year-old? Why the rye is 7 years old? Who knows? But that is the mash bill. According to their website, the aroma is sweet maple and vanilla with hints of nuttiness and baking spice. Their taste is brown sweets with a hint of fruitiness and black pepper. That's how they describe it. I'm going to tell you how I describe it. This Knob Creek Bourbon and Rye, to me, it's very savory. I mean, very, very savory. But surprisingly uninteresting. I got to tell you, it's not my favorite. Now, normally, something super savory would be right in my wheelhouse. But I think the rye, combination of the rye with the bourbon, the rye really cuts the sweetness of the bourbon. Now, it has an interesting burn level. Again, it's 113 proof. What is it? Yeah, 113 proof. So there's definitely a burn there, but it's a muted burn from the first sip to the last. I mean, it really doesn't hurt you at all. So that's actually very interesting about the product. But I have to say, I'm not in love with this. I don't think I would buy it again. And I like a lot of Knob Creek products. I like the Knob Creek 9-year-old. I like the 9-year-old better than the 12-year-old, but I like the 9-year-old quite a bit. But this Knob Creek Bourbon and Rye, it's okay, but I'm not in love with it. Wouldn't buy it again. It does get sweeter if you put it on ice. I mean, the bourbon starts to come through. When it opens up when you put it on ice or open it up with some water. So that's Knob Creek's Bourbon and Rye, that blend. All right, folks. I have a quick announcement to make, and then we're going to wrap things up. I will be getting on a plane Friday morning to head down to Augusta to attend the Saturday and Sunday rounds of the Masters this year. So next week's show will be a Masters wrap-up show. I'll give you my impressions of what took place over the weekend rounds. Obviously, we'll compare this visit to the Masters to the other two. This will be my third trip to the Masters. So we'll compare this year's trip to the other two, and I'll tell you what I found interesting and what I found uninteresting, which is probably very, 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 very little about the 2025 Masters. But until then, as always, I want to remind you to tell your friends to watch, tell your friends to listen, tell your enemies to watch, tell your enemies to listen. Spread the word about Stomp the Tea. We're here for you, and we will give you content you can't find anywhere else online each and every week. So, with that, my name is Cyrus Farmer. This is the Stomp the Tea podcast. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And once again, as always, we will see you on the first tee.